didn't get to get to the advocate subscription page, back up here for you yet again. Like I said, I know y'all got your phones with you. And tomorrow will be third time's charm for this dinosaur QR code, which, by the way, everybody seems to love. That's, I think I've got just as many comments on that as the other parts. All right, so yesterday we went from AD 70 in those events all the way up in a whirlwind tour towards 1898 with the arrival of the Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, to Jerusalem, and that really kind of cemented the connection between Germany and the Ottoman Empire. Other events going on worldwide also have relevance for Jerusalem, and we're going to review these again today. The first Zionist Congress was held in 1897 in Switzerland. It was mostly the result of this man's work, Theodor Herzl. And I think this is stuff that we're largely familiar with, but it's bears repeating. You know, Europe in the 19th century was going through periods of extreme anti-Semitism. The prevailing thought among Jewish leaders and thinkers of that time was the best course of action was for the Jews to either assimilate fully into society or to look to leave Europe en masse for some other, more possibly favorable nation like America or even Argentina was thrown out there. Herzl was at the forefront of a counter movement to that, those ideas, and that was Zionism. Zionism is a Jewish nationalist movement that has its goal in the creation and support of a Jewish national state in the land of Israel. That is reflected in the goal of the conference, which is up there on the slide. And this is a very famous quote that most of you probably heard, but after the first Zionist Congress in Switzerland, Herzl wrote the following in his diary. He said, "If I have to sum up the Basel Congress in one word, which I would not do openly, it would be this: at Basel, I founded the Jewish state. If I were to say this today, it would be greeted by universal laughter. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 50, everybody will see it." Now, of course, we know he is going to be proved correct in his optimism here. And it must be noted that this is a political movement. This is not religious. Herzl was a diplomat and a politician. And that's his focus. Now, another important development was, as we're familiar with, was the Balfour Declaration, which was in 1917, and this is a statement of British support for the establishment of, in Palestine, of a national home for the Jewish people. It was made in a letter from Arthur James Balfour, who was the British Foreign Secretary, to the British, to leaders of the British Jewish community. And it was for transmission to the Zionist Federation of Great Britain and Ireland. And this letter, why it becomes so important, it becomes adopted as part of post-World War I treaties. And this declaration aroused enthusiastic hopes among Zionists and seemed to be the fulfillment of the World Zionist Congress. And in 1917, the British actually take Jerusalem. It's going to be a little dark, but we'll actually try for you to see this. I'm sure most of you have seen stills from this, but this is old BBC News footage. In contrast to the Kaiser writing in, it was advised to Allenby that he walk in. And just kind of fun fact, in the next set here, in that group that walks in, Lawrence of Arabia is actually one of the people walking in with Allenby, along with Sykes-Picot, who is the French diplomat that, if you're familiar with history, the treaties are actually named after him. But this was potentially done in direct contrast to the Germans writing that way. So, we'll spend one more minute on this moment of history. Turn with me to Leviticus 26. I'm not going to read the whole thing. we're going to do some jumping around here. Leviticus 26, and I'm going to start at verse 27. And if you will not for all this hearken unto me, but walk contrary unto me, then I will walk contrary unto you. Also in fury, I will chastise you seven times for your sins. Now let's skip down to 31. And I will make your cities waste and bring your sanctuaries into desolation. I will not smell the savor of your sweet odors. I will bring the land into desolation, and your enemies which dwelt therein shall be astonished at it. And I will scatter you among the nation, the heathen, and you will draw the sword after you, and your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. Then shall the land enjoy her Sabbaths as long as it lieth desolate. And if ye be in your enemy's land, even then shall the land rest and enjoy her Sabbaths. Let's skip down to 42. Then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, also my covenant with Isaac, and also my covenant with Abraham. I remember it, and I will remember the land. So, you know, we know this from the Leviticus 26 year prophecy that that God tells the Israelites that he will walk contrary to them, and he will chastise them seven times for their sins. If we take seven times is equal to 360 for a prophetic year principle, that would be 2,520 years. Beginning at 604 BC is really when the kingdom of Judah and by extension Israel come to an end, right? This is the start of the downfall of them with the Babylonian destruction. After that point, they are either ruled as part of an empire, or when they are independent, they are actually headed by somebody not from the line of David, and not by a high priest from the family of Aaron. So if we take that seven times as that starting point and do the math, we actually get up to 1917. In his book, A Life of the Last Days, Grant McGinnis saw this prophetic time period and did the math, and he suggested that this year, 1917, is consequently doubly indicated as a final crisis date in which the seven times run out. There can be no question those who live to see this year in 1917 will have reached one of the most important, perhaps momentous, of these terminal years of crisis. And I think his writing was correct, right? We see here a power, the Ottoman Empire drying up. We see a power very favorable to the Jews, open up an opportunity for dramatic changes in the land of Israel. Now, before we romanticize the British too much here, we have to remember that the time of what is called the Palestinian Mandate, or Mandate Palestine, was not pleasant. I think this figure helps set the stage a lot. As you can see, we can see annual Jewish immigration here. This is what this number is. It's the number of individual Jews coming in to the land over time. And in 1935, right here, we get a big jump. And then immediately, as you notice, after 1935, it drops way down again. This comes on the heels of several, this is explained by several key events. For one, the British government of post-World War I, the one running the 20s, was not the government of pre-World War I Britain. The support of the Jews and the Balfour Declaration after the war had waned. In addition, the British had done a really good job at angering the Arabs with their carving up of the Middle East at the end of the war. If you've seen Lawrence of Arabia's movie, you know how mad he is at the end with all that peace stuff. It's because, truth is, this is colonial Britain. They are really, really good at lying to everybody. They're lying to the Jews, they're lying to the Arabs, they're lying to people in their own government continually. It is not a really pleasant political situation. Also, The Jewish population in Israel is getting to be much more over-organized and what we would call like overtly nation building. They're setting up universities. They're establishing infrastructure. They're formalizing political organizations. So around 1934, 1935, you see this giant peak. And that's the year the Arab population of Jerusalem decides the British aren't going to halt Jewish immigration, so they revolt. And the revolt is largely led by this man. He's the one on the left. This is Haj Amin al-Husseini. He is the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. I assume everybody recognizes the guy on the right. A mufti is a jurist who is able to give non-binding rules on Islamic law. In Jerusalem, his post, the post he had, is actually to be in charge of the Dome of the Rock and other Islamic holy sites. Al-Husseini came from a long line of a wealthy Jerusalem family, and he's actually appointed to this post by the British government in 1921. In 1935, he turns against the British and pushes for rebellion against the mandate. And as you would expect, he is exceptionally anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist. The British try to arrest him, but he flees, gets to Italy, meets Mussolini, and eventually, as you can see, gets to meet with Hitler. In this meeting, he and Hitler share their common goals of destruction of the Jews, and the Mufti requests from Hitler his own country of Palestine and Syria. The Mufti, of course, is totally a reprehensible person. He would also use this revolt to remove all of his political rivals from Jerusalem. Very kind of mafia style. Anybody who disagreed with him, he was wiping them out. So anyone that was open to peace with the Jews or supportive of the British, they were all killed on his orders. And this, of course, just makes a worse situation even worse. Now, because this is all going on during the onset and early part of World War II, the British cannot effectively put down this Arab revolt. They need more help. So to compensate for their lack of troops in the area, they start recruiting and training Jewish soldiers to fight the Arabs who are under revolt. This probably doesn't help Jewish-Arab relations anymore because it just puts them in more open rebellion. And it's going to be a little ironic because pretty soon these British-trained Jewish soldiers are going to start rebelling against the British as well. Let's get rid of these two and move on. So, I don't know if anybody would recognize this man. Actually, that's pretty good. This is Neville Chamberlain. His life is intimately tied to that of Hitler in Jerusalem. Neville Chamberlain famously said, "Peace in our time," when he attempted to placate Hitler by letting him invade Czechoslovakia in 1938. Anyway, Chamberlain is the prime minister during this time of the Arab revolt. Now, one upshot of this agreement with Hitler to let him have Czechoslovakia was there were actually several thousand British troops in Czechoslovakia at the time to hold the Germans at bay. As soon as Chamberlain says you can have it, that frees up all those troops, and then they get redeployed in Jerusalem to crush the Arab revolt. Chamberlain also very famously revokes the Balfour Declaration. And he does it under the following logic. By the time we get to the mid-1930s in Europe, he realizes that the Jews in Mandate Palestine are never going to support the Germans once war breaks out. He knows it. Everybody knew the policies of the Germans. Everybody knew how they viewed the Jews. Chamberlain looks at this very politically and says, doesn't matter what we say, what we do, the Jews are going to be against Germany. No problem. However, he goes, the Arabs have a choice. They get to pick a side. And his quote was, To court the Arab nations, he said, quote, if we must offend one side, let us offend the Jews rather than the Arabs. So his government moves against the Balfour Declaration and starts actually creating a lot of policies to appease the Arabs and be contrary to the Jews in Palestine. His government issued what's called the White Paper, which did the following things. It's up there on the slide for you if you want to see it, but I'm going to say it to you. One, it limited Jewish land purchases. Two, it capped immigration of Jews at 15,000 annually for 5 years. And after 5 years, the Arabs in charge could veto any immigration. So in effect, it's going to stop immigration. And it promised a Palestinian state in 10 years. Furthermore, it said no Jewish state. a book I have liked, it's in the slide deck if you want to see it, but it's a book called Jerusalem, a Biography. That's the title. I think it's by Simon Montefiore. It's a very good book. I listen to the audiobook. It's enjoyable. This tells you what kind of nerd I am. The book has footnotes, and the audiobook reads the footnotes, which I really like. And I find enjoyable and pleasing. But anyway, he writes about this event in the history of Jerusalem. He writes, this was the best offer the Palestinians were to receive from the British or anyone else during the entire 20th century. But the Mufti displaying spectacular political incompetence and megalomaniacal intransience, rejected it from his Lebanese exile. He says, I want Syria and Palestine. I'm going to side with Hitler. I'll pass on getting my own state for my people. So he rejects it. However, the White Paper still put into effect, and the British changed. Just after the White Paper was put into effect, the British changed governments yet again. Now, not all these propositions went into effect. However, the immigration was still reduced. That gets it back to this chart. So in 1939, it became official policy of the British government to limit Jewish immigration into the land to a number of 75,000 over a period of 5 years. So sadly, it coincides with Hitler's obvious persecution of the Jews and the institution of the Final Solution. So European Jews who were in desperate need of sanctuary had nowhere to go because of this policy. They had nowhere to go. This also sets the stage for the Israeli war against the British, because all of these British-trained and organized Jewish soldiers are now working on one thing, and one thing only. That's smuggling in immigrants in defiance of the British quotas, and they're also preparing for the end of World War II when they can revolt against the British. So after World War II, here's our first map. Britain is finding that the area known as Palestine is effectively ungovernable. The Palestinians have been aligned with Germany. The Jews are undertaking a guerrilla war in response to the White Paper. Britain doesn't want to give up control, but they just can't manage it, right? They're in a post-World War II wrecked economy, just having come out by the skin of their teeth kind of victory. This is not a place that they are really wanting to be able to manage. So they turned to the brand new United Nations for help. The United Nations Special Committee on Palestine sends an international delegation to Israel to do fact-finding and to make a decision. During the visit, the Palestinian leadership barricade themselves inside Jerusalem and refused to meet the committee. The rest of the leadership, like the Mufti, is largely in exile outside the country, but they're not interested in the UN either. In contrast, I guess in kind of modern marketing parlance or whatever, the Jewish delegation basically crushes it, right? As I said earlier, the Jews had done a really good job of effectively nation building or nation preparation in the previous decades, and this is one way all that organization shows off. They are super cooperative with the UN. They got a lot of detailed thoughts. They're doing really well reasoned out logic. They present several options about what would be acceptable to them. And so on one hand, you have one group saying, we're not going to talk at all, go away. And another one saying, here's everything we would consider, and we're more than happy to work with you. Now, there is an argument, however, that the Palestinians and the Arabs should have boycotted the process, as the UN had no right to make decisions about their futures. You shouldn't participate in an illegitimate process. You still hear that argument even said today. Maybe you could say that, but that's not wholly true, and it is also super politically naive. For one, the British had been in control for 3 decades, right? The British had been in control for 3 decades, and the Ottomans had been in control for centuries before that. You know, foreign powers are going to have to be dealt with and negotiated with in some form during this process, right? You just can't ignore them. You can't pretend they're not there. And also, too, as we just showed, the process, as it said, had been set up, had been really, really favorable to the Palestinians. Remember, the white paper had been talking about giving them the entire land and no Jewish state. They could have had their own state and a favorable allocation. Also, too, as we see, none of the surrounding nations are going to be looking out for the Palestinians' interests. But they're going to come up with their own designs on the land as well. Anyway, the UN's work is not as illegitimate as many people would make it out to sound nowadays. Anyway, the committee is given a majority and minority opinion. The majority opinion is this idea of partition. The second opinion is a single nation with a federated government. The UN passes the partition recommendation in 1947. So just quickly, the partition map actually reflects the priorities and the immigration patterns of the Jewish people for the past few decades. You may say, well, how do they end up with this kind of crazy quilt of a thing? Remember I said Herzl and eventually the people who sign up for what he's selling, they're not necessarily all religious. They're practical folks. They are coming to farm and build farms and build kibbutzes. So they want farmland. This is exactly the strip of land when they show up, they start buying from the Ottomans and other Arab rulers. This is the farmland area of Israel. This is all mountainous and not really farm area. But they're coming up here buying farmland, and then here is where Tiberias and Galilee are. Tiberias had been a very long-standing Jewish area, and so it made sense how they kind of made up with this map. Now, Ben-Gurion, who's going to be kind of the father of George Washington figure of Israel, was not happy with having Jerusalem left out of this map, but he said, quote, losing her is the price of statehood, and so he accepted that. Now, immediately, violence starts breaking out, and by all accounts, the violence was initiated by the Palestinians. This becomes a major point moving forward. Instead of choosing to establish a nation alongside, the Palestinian leadership decides to start a war to stop the other nation from having developed. So with the partition plan, by the UN, the British are going to leave Palestine. Now, we talk about 1948 a lot as a war between Israel and Arabs, as the war for independence. But it's really two different conflicts with two different sets of actors. The first phase is effectively a civil war between Palestinians and irregular volunteers from the neighboring nations with the Jews. And we call it a civil war, in effect, because all of them had been under the British, right? We're talking about people who had all been in the same British area now going to fight each other. This is smaller scale fighting, and it even starts while the British are still there. By the time the British leave, the Jews are effectively defending themselves and starting to win. The second phase of the war starts when the British leave and the declaration of the State of Israel. They leave on May 14th, and in Israel and in the history of this time, there is a lot of bitterness about the way the British leave. They didn't coordinate with the Jewish agency. They just got up and walked away. And so they have this pressure cooker of battles and war and animosity going on. And instead of trying to do any coordination or make anything safe, they just dust their hands and they're out. This picture, of course, is the very famous announcement of the nation of Israel. I guess we can also add that both the United States and the Soviet Union recognized the nation of Israel once it was established. The U.S. the same day, it took the Russians 3 days later. It's kind of interesting in this space. Stalin, who is the premier or president or whatever he would have been of the USSR at this time, he is exceptionally anti-Semitic. He is not anti-Semitic. So he is not embracing Israel in any kind of love of its people. A lot of the Jewish population were communists and socialists. They came from Eastern European. They are setting up a largely socialist country. That's why the USSR supports them. Nevertheless, regardless, going on, the U.S. in 1948 does not send arms to Israel formally. The USSR doesn't either. Israel is largely left to defend themselves. They end up getting most of their weaponry from buying it up from the Czechs and other Eastern European countries. There are, of course, some American Jews who provide support and buy some arms and stuff like that, but there's nothing formal from the Western powers to support them. So this introduces the second phase of the war. I don't know. I feel like I'm a little bit in the way, but maybe you can kind of see around me. Immediately with this declaration, the neighboring Arab nations announce they're going to invade. Now, just a quick comment. The nation of Israel is a miracle. The nation of Israel is there because of God. However, there's a lot of kind of mythology associated with the founding of nation of Israel, a lot of stories. I think it's a miracle that doesn't need any embellishments or what might be even exaggeration by later generations. So I'm going to try to keep this very factual. The Arab armies are going to invade with larger numbers, but they're going to be inferior soldiers. They're going to be poorly led, and they're dealing with competing and secret agendas. The Arab leaders don't trust each other. And in fact, most of them don't trust their own populations. So they're going to come in with some problems there. They also underestimate the Jews, overestimate their own military prowess. And as a result, they don't prepare at all. Even though everybody in the world could see war was coming. Everybody knew this is going to play out. Even after there starts to be civil war outbreak going on while the British are still there. And it's as obvious as everybody knows, as soon as the British leave, it's going to get worse. The neighboring Arabs are not preparing. They send in semi-regular soldiers and some sort of combination army. Also, it's a really poorly kept secret that King Abdullah of Transjordan wants to expand his kingdom into the West Bank. As a boy, he traveled to Jerusalem and fell in love with the city. And so since he has been a child, all he has wanted to do is rule Jerusalem. That's it. That's been a life goal of his. He doesn't care about anything else. Egypt also wants to grab land too. They're also being largely reactionary. During the past year, they sat on the sidelines when they thought the Palestinians could win. And as we said, it was very clear by 1948 that the Palestinians were not organized enough to win, and already Palestinians were leaving Jewish areas because they didn't want to be part of the war zone, they didn't want to be part of the Jewish state. Whatever the reason, the key point is the Arab nations, particularly Transjordan, are not coming in to save Palestinians. That was never on their objective. They are coming to stop Palestinians from fleeing into their own lands, or because they are going to take land and they know the Palestinians are going to lose. There's also a lesson about the problems of propaganda in this war. The Arab nations did famously say that they were going to drive the Druze to the sea. They did that, of course, to rally up their own troops, their own populace. Their populace believed them, but more importantly, the Jews who were in Israel believed them. And we're going to circle back to this theme in a while, but it helps establish that any war is always an existential crisis for Jerusalem. If we think about what this map looks like, Jewish refugees have nowhere to go. And that's going to be Israel's position up until the current day. Israel cannot lose a war and survive as a nation. So all of this combines into the Jewish population doing a heroic and achieving a miraculous victory. At the onset of the war, the Jewish leaders were not looking to expand territory. That was not their interest. But once they are pushed into a corner, it's not solely about defense. They start to press their advantage, and they start to expand their borders, as you can see in the series of maps up there. At the end of the war, So here's where we start. All of these invading start moving in, and it kind of pushes the borders a little bit back, but by the end, the Jewish population is... The Jews in here are pushing further out and actually taking new territory as they push these armies back further and further and further. At the end of the war, Transjordan, or what we call Jordan now, gets the West Bank and Jerusalem. So King Abdullah is happy. There actually is a story. He loved Jerusalem so much that he wanted to move his capital to Jerusalem. But he didn't think he could do it politically without angering either international powers or his own people. Like, that's how happy he was with that city. All right. So, the war of 1948-1949 ends in a divided city. The Jewish nation now includes Western Jerusalem, but Jordan got Eastern Jerusalem and the West Bank, just like the king wanted. Egypt also got some land in this process. So the surrounding nations are actually not too unhappy with how this turned out. Jordan is not blame-free in all this, right? They prohibit the Jews from visiting the Western Wall. They destroy synagogues in parts of the old city. Also, Jerusalem starts to have very kind of the feel of a very classic Cold War city, kind of Cold War Berlin. With walls and barbed wire prohibiting movements around at this time. So we're going to skip to the next decade, and what we have in the 1950s is what we call the rise of Pan-Arabism, which is kind of a term describing the Arab nations as a single group of people with common interests and kind of an attempt to collectively exert more power on the world stage. Now, the main face of Pan-Arabism is the man in the center of this picture in the suit. He is Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was a young member of the Egyptian military that was deployed as part of the war in 1948 against Israel. He comes back to Egypt disillusioned as a member of a coup that deposes the Egyptian king. Nasser becomes president of Egypt, and through his handling of the Suez Canal crisis, which is a conflict between Syria and Turkey, he becomes a leading figure of the Arab world and the effective leader of both Egypt and Syria. His backers in Syria effectively defer to him. And all this turns to set the stage for the 1967 war, or the Six-Day War. And there's a lot of forces working at the same time, so I'll try not to be too confusing with them. I also try to keep commentary to a minimum here. Israel started taking water from the Jordan River in the north. Right? Syria uses the Golan Heights area. in response to start to shell Israeli infrastructure and settlements, which is all in violation of UN orders and instructions. This starts to create skirmishes between Israel and Syria, and Israel is even shooting down some Syrian fighter jets. So this is all in this backdrop. In May 1967, the Soviet Union decides to tell Nasser that Israel is amassing troops at the northern border in order to invade Syria. This, of course, is completely false. The UN observers and the peacekeepers in the north are saying there is no troop buildup whatsoever. There is nothing going on. And it appears why the Soviets did this was just to try to use the Israeli Arab tensions to kind of stir the pot, if you will, and to distract the U.S. Right? We are in the height of Cold War politics, where one little skirmish over here between somebody will get the attention of the U.S., and they use that to get the attention of the Russians somewhere over here. This is all just massive global politics with obscure reasons that really have nothing to do with the battles on the ground. That's why the Soviets are saying, hey, Nasser, they're gonna invade. But it's not true. Nasser, however, in Egypt, decides to believe the Soviet Union. Now, after the Suez Canal crisis, the UN had put peacekeepers in the Sinai, so Nasser expels them, and he moves 200,000 troops up to the border with Israel. Syria, as Egypt's ally, also starts moving troops down. Now, Nasser's calculations, according to historians, are kind of the following. One, he believes what the Soviets are telling him. Two, he believes that the U.S. will stop or at least restrain Israel in any kind of battle. That's exactly what happened in the Suez Canal crisis. The U.S. told Israel, hey, take your foot off the gas, ease up, let's just go back to where we were. He's also always looking for reasons and opportunity to enhance his prestige as the leader of the Arab world, right? He decides a confrontation with Israel is one way to do that. It's a politically popular move and one that makes him look better than the King of Jordan, right? Think about it. Nasser's going to get tough on Israel, where for the past, you know, two decades, Jordan's just been sitting around going, hey, everything's fine. He's also overconfident in his military. His advisors, he's surrounded himself by a bunch of yes men who tell him everything is great when it is really not. His military is nowhere as good as he thinks it is. But he doesn't know that. Nasser will say things publicly like, quote, we aim at the destruction of the state of Israel. The immediate aim, perfection of Arab military might. The national aim, eradication of Israel. Another quote, we shall not enter Palestine with its soil covered in sand. We shall enter it with soil saturated in blood. The shorter man next to Nasser, he is King Hussein of Jordan. He's actually against war with Israel. Remember, he has what he wants. He wanted Jerusalem. He's got it. He sees no advantages to having a war. Like, he's got nothing to gain, only stuff to lose. However, he has to go along with Nasser. Nasser in Egypt had been part of a coup that got rid of one king. Nasser was influential in Syria, who got rid of their king. Nasser supported the overthrow of the Iraqi monarchy and set up ties with their new leadership. Nasser has a lot of supporters in Lebanon. If you're King Hussein of Jordan, you're really not a big fan of a guy with this much power and a track record of getting kings overthrown, right? However, you gotta go along with him. He's just too popular, and it would really look bad for Jordan after 20 years to do nothing about Israel if Nasser defeats the Jews without you. So Jordan puts their troops under Egyptian command. As a further escalation, Nasser then blocks the Straits of Tiran to cut off Israel's southernmost port of the Red Sea. This, of course, is very much brinksmanship, and this has the Israelis very afraid. So you can see on the map all of the movement of Arab armies towards Israel. When faced with this threat, the Israelis turned to this man up here. That guy, that is Moshe Dayan. He's probably Israel's greatest military leader ever. He's put in charge of defenses and orchestrates a preemptive attack on Egypt. And this is better than what I can do. So this is probably a little brighter than the last view. This is a nice summary from the BBC. There's no sound. So it's over in 6 days. It's pretty amazing. Dayan is very influential because after capturing East Jerusalem, he immediately puts the Arab leaders in charge of the Dome of the Rock and the Temple Mount. He also prevented Jewish soldiers from praying on the Temple Mount. There's a couple of these arrangements hold today, right? Very famously, there's a couple of interesting stories from this one. Related to this war, Dayan shows up and the Jewish soldiers are starting to raise a flag over the Dome of the Rock. He immediately says, stop it, pull that down, we're not doing that. And he kind of sets up the fraught relationship and situation we have on all of that is not set up by any politicians. Basically, Dayan on the ground saying, this is how things are going to work. And we're just going to keep things calm this way. In terms of the war also, there's another interesting story. I believe this is true. Nassar is anxious to see what's going to happen with his troops in the buildup. So he gets on a plane with his chief of the Air Force. The chief of the Air Force was not the best chief. I think he had a significant drug problem and had also a problem with money, lying, and women. But he's telling Nassar everything he wants to hear. So they get on the plane, start to fly over Sinai, and they get on the radio. No, you got to turn around and go back. Because the Israelis are in the air, and they've wiped all of our planes out, and you're going to get shot down if you go any further. So they have to turn around and bail. Anyway. So it's a dramatic victory for Israel. So, how are we doing here? We have covered a lot of history today. This is a 19th century photograph. You can see the Dome of the Rock. It's the black thing on the right. It's not gold because by the time in the 19th century, it actually had a lead roof. The gold had been stripped off earlier by some sultan and wasn't replaced in the 20th century. So, what's the status of Israel today? I'll admit this is really hard for me to keep up with. I'm sure most of y'all feel the same thing, as everything changes very quickly. And overall, it's complex. I think most of us would say we have an okay understanding of what Israel is facing in the world. We understand that Hamas is in Gaza, to an extent Hezbollah in Syria. We now have threat and kind of past threat of war with Iran and the PLO in the West Bank. We know that God is in charge and is directing world events that are in a way that is according to his will. We also know that Israel is and will be a flashpoint for world events, and ultimately that all peoples of the earth will be gathered against it, as Zechariah states. So as we try to watch that development, what forces, what trends might we be looking to that are moving Israel and the world to that day? So I'm going to try to describe this the best I can. By no means an expert. This is going to be insufficient. This is insufficient in an oversimplification. But I hope we can walk away from here with a better understanding of what's going on than the average American or Canadian, although I would assume our Canadian brothers and sisters know a lot more of world politics than we Americans do. That's not something we're really good at. There are two forces that I'm going to, or a set of forces that I would describe as internal and external. And which of these is critical or the real kind of event that's key to God's plan, I don't know. I don't really think anybody can know. They just help us get the overall picture, I think. And they're not independent, and they push and pull on each other and react with each other, but we'll try to go through them. So, we have those internal ones and those external ones we'll deal with here. First, internal. If you think the U.S. has a really partisan split, you don't know partisanship in a divided population until you consider Israel today. Israel is a parliamentary system. They have a single chamber. That's the Knesset. For those of us here in the U.S. has the Senate and the House. Israel just has one body with proportional representation. If your party gets more than 3% of the vote, you get a seat. In Israel, you also don't vote for people. You vote for a party. So right now, the Knesset has 11 parties that have seats in it. Also, like Britain, they have a prime minister. The prime minister is elected by the Knesset. Generally, it's the party with the most votes gets to pick their person. Also, it is an unlimited number of times. And so what you can see from this map is a narrow, narrow majority for the purple, red, and gray sides, right? This kind of side over here. And we're going to basically call this left and right for the most part. But you have a very, very narrow majority. The right is historic conservatives, the orthodox parties, and newer national parties. On the left are the traditional liberals and the Arabs, and I'm using these political labels, which are reductionist, but I'm keeping this high level to keep us moving. No party has a single majority. That means the prime minister, on one hand, whoever gets elected prime minister is not liked by a lot of people, right? A lot of people, right off the bat, he or she was not going to be their choice. In fact, I've seen recent polling that suggests that about only 20% of the population trusts Netanyahu, right? That sounds about right, because only about 20% of the people really like him. That's part of the anti-Netanyahu explanation. The majority just didn't vote for his party. And even if you're in his coalition, you may not like him either. And right off the bat, the remaining half of the country doesn't like him. So this also helps explain a lot of the news that we hear out of Israel. To be prime minister with this non-majority party, he has to form a coalition of parties to get a majority. No majority, no government, back to voting. His coalition is the ultra-Orthodox and the nationalist parties. This creates some of the political tension we see. Because they aren't part of his party, they don't share all of his politics. For example, the ultra-Orthodox parties usually just go with whoever will give them concessions. The concessions they've gotten in the past are things like government allowances to study the Torah, like actually being funded to study the Torah, not get a job, or to be exempted from the military. That was a big thing come up recently that the Supreme Court said, that, yeah, that's probably not legal. They should be in the military. To keep in power, Netanyahu promises he'll try to defend those benefits to keep him in his coalition. And this is why you saw that back and forth, because it threatened Netanyahu and he would be kicked out. Likewise, the nationalist parties really represent mostly the settlers in the West Bank and are more right-wing individuals, and they have not liked any of the ceasefire push from Hamas. So whenever you hear some minister in Netanyahu's government who will say, we don't want a ceasefire with Hamas and all those things, it's usually coming out of those parties. He's giving them jobs because they're part of his coalition. Again, if there's a ceasefire, they leave, no majority, no government, Netanyahu doesn't get to be prime minister anymore. And this dynamic has actually pushed Israeli politics more and more to what we call the right. To form a government, Netanyahu has increasingly embraced more militant and national groups to stay in power. This is a clear arc of change over time. You can see this movement with every one of his administrations. And by all accounts, Netanyahu really, 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 and I mean really, wants to be prime minister. Like I did. So he will do whatever he can to stay in power. If you just read, just watch interviews with this man, particularly older ones, that's what he thinks he is supposed to be, and whatever he can do to be there, he will do. This political shift is also mirrored or reinforced by demographic changes. Oh no, we're out of time. I'm going over, aren't I? Nobody said stop. Okay, wow, it's going to have to get a little quicker tomorrow. Okay, we will pick up with this briefly tomorrow and then move on to what's the future of Israel and Jerusalem, hopefully. Thank y'all for the attention. Sorry for going over.